This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, you look like you just had an orb encounter.
I don't, does that mean I look more serene and like happy and more, you know, full of hope and just joy?
It could be, although I was talking more about the sand on your feet and the fact that you're wearing a swimsuit and...
Oh, yes.
And you keep, you know, making these weird yelling sounds as you jump around the room.
Ow! Yeah, it's hot, you know?
Right.
I apologize that I didn't get out of my skin-tight bathing suit attire before we recorded. I meant to change, but apparently orb experiences... change your clothes, but then don't change them back.
That's a malfunction in the orb.
Yeah, malfunctioning orbs are the worst, Chris.
I think Kaiopaka needs to hit check update on that orb and see if maybe they've pushed out, the prophets have pushed out a little software update for that.
refresh.
All right. Well, we're talking about this because today we're going to talk about Emissary. This is something that many of you guys listening have asked us about in the Babel Conference and elsewhere for a long time. And although we do mention Emissary constantly on the show, we've never really sat down and broken it down and really, really dug in to the pilot of Deep Space Nine.
Is that how we're going to break it down, Chris? Or
I guess so, but I can use that sound effect now as a transition on the ready room, I think.
That's when we transition from the other side of the orb.
I guess so, yeah. All right, so we're going to do this in two parts because it is a double-length episode, and we're going to do the first half of Emissary today, and we're going to do the other half in the next show. And Matthew, we decided what we're going to break when they head off in the runabout to go to the Denorius belt, right?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting because I thought that on Netflix that this was split up into two episodes, and actually Netflix shows it just like the DVD does in one long continuous story, which is great. But, you know, if you watch it on television and you've got Deep Space Nine syndicated somewhere, they do break it up at this point. And so I had to look up to see where that was, and... the breaking point is the point where they have disabled the Cardassian ship and the runabout is headed off to the Denorius belt. And so, yeah, it's an okay place to break. I mean, honestly, this is a pilot and it wasn't meant to really be broken up into two parts.
Yeah, there's often not a great place to break these pilots or any episode, you know, because Voyager had a number of episodes that were double-length episodes to begin with. So there's often not a good place to break these, but that's where we're going to stop today because that's where they've been breaking it. And we're going to talk about, you know, different aspects of Emissary. We're going to talk about some of the character introductions, setting the tone and such. And in fact, setting the tone is our first topic, Matthew. That's the natural place to start. And I've said this here before, I've said it on the Ready Room as well, I'm sure, that I remember when they were developing this series and waiting for it to come on and then watching it for the first time and taking in firsthand how they were going to make this distinction between The Next Generation and this new series, because obviously you don't want to have two really similar series on at the same time. But Star Trek fans expect a certain thing from Star Trek, so anytime you start messing with that recipe, you're not sure how it's going to turn out. And so they kind of eased us into it here by having the Enterprise there at the station, a meeting with Picard. Of course, we have Miles there as well. And we even have some musical cues from TNG at certain moments that really help us ease into it. So what are your thoughts on how Emissary sets the tone for the new series?
Well, you know, right away, it is a visceral start because they are beginning with Wolf 359. So they're taking us back to, you know, one of the most harrowing things to happen in TNG. And, you know, one of the downfalls of when TNG was on screen is that there was very little fallout to an episode as big as Best of Both Worlds. I mean, the biggest fallout was Picard going home and family, which was great they did that. But how that would have affected the Federation and losing starships, and I mean, you had a captain who had been turned into the enemy and all of that. Well, smartly, the writers here use that as a platform, you know, is a diving point to just jump right in. And I think that sets the tone immediately to say, you're not used to seeing consequences in Star Trek, but this show is going to be about all the consequences. We're going to do all the consequences of things because we're not going to move from place to place to place where we don't ever have to see what happens because of the decisions we've made. Like, you know, Kirk talking a robot to death that, you know, destroys the very foundation of a planet's life and be like, see you later. You know, here we're going to be responsible for a whole planet hopefully coming into the Federation. And I think starting this way, the tone is clear. It's not just that it's going to be darker or grittier, because that's what everybody says.
Those were the buzzwords at the time, for sure. Those were the buzzwords in the media even before it launched. It was like, this is going to be the darker, grittier Star Trek.
But it just sets the tone. I think it's not darker and grittier. It's just consequential. It's going to deal with everything that happens after you make the decision.
Yeah.
And well, that's cool.
It's real life, right? I mean, you can describe it as darker and grittier, but I think it's simply that there is realism in the storytelling.
Well, life is messy, even in the 24th century. And you know, even the dichotomy between the Enterprise set and then the sets you get with Deep Space Nine, there's a huge difference there. I mean, I was struck by, and you know, we're in Star Wars just overload right now with The Force Awakens coming out, but one of the things Star Wars did and George set up in the very first film was in what he called a lived universe. You felt like people actually lived in it. The ships look like they've looked, you know, lived in, all of the kind of stuff. Deep Space Nine feels like a lived universe of Star Trek. And when you go back to the Enterprise, it feels so stark and almost silly. It's like, it doesn't feel homey. It just feels like a mental ward or something, you know, like everything. It doesn't feel like people actually would want to live there.
Yeah. Well, inside some of the quarters, maybe. Some of the crew have nice quarters.
That's but true. Yeah. I mean, Worf has that wonderful chair, that really strange, like, ball chair.
Yeah, right. Well, as we know from Insurrection, Troy has an old-style bathtub in the middle of her quarters, just sitting out in the middle of the room.
She's got a hot tub in her, like, it's a jacuzzi-style tub.
I think Riker has the jacuzzi. Probably has it on the series. We just never see it.
That's true. He likes to prop his leg up on that a lot, and... Anyway,
but I think what you're describing is something, and we see it on Voyager as well, that the environment just feels clean and pristine all the time, right? There's no carryover. Like the ship, especially on Voyager, the ship may get wrecked during an episode, but then in the next episode or the next few episodes, it's going to look pristine again. And I don't know when they found the time to clean it up so much, but they did. But of course, part of that is a product of television of the time where you want to make these episodes that are standalones. They can be aired in any order. You don't want the audience to be wondering what's happened to the ship here, what's happened to the ship there. Now, if it's always that way, so like you mentioned Star Wars, we could also mention Battlestar Galactica and a number of other shows where the ship always feels lived in, then you don't have that problem so much, right?
Well, I mean, we just didn't see it, Chris, but you, Kathy was spending so many Starfleet credits on car washes for the, you know, every planet stop, like, you know, get it washed, get it waxed.
Yeah. Well, I think after she got upset at Chakotay about the gift of the watch, I think the next time he gave her a Roomba instead, he was going for something practical.
For when her, you know, her tea and crumpets and coffee and cakes get, you know, messed up on the floor of the carpet there. Yeah.
That's right. Well, anyway, so yeah, lived in universe, I know what you mean. And there is that contrast in the sets here. I think when we talk about other things that set the tone, of course, you said the Battle of 359, and in TNG, the series, we didn't really get to see that battle at all, right? We saw the remnants of the battle, and it wasn't until First Contact that we actually got to see what happened. And even then, we were on the winning side from our point of view, being aboard the Enterprise. But what happens here is not only do we get to see the battle, which I remember at the time was just incredibly awesome, I was so excited to see what was actually happening in the battle instead of just looking at the dead shells of all the ships. But also we get to see what it's like for the Starfleet officers who had to go through that battle and weren't safe and sound aboard the Enterprise. And that, again, showed that, like we said earlier, life is messy. There is actually a lot of strife even in the 24th century. And that's something that we just weren't really shown so much on TNG.
I mean, when you're inadvertently responsible for the death of a lot of Starfleet officers, it would be hard-pressed to there not be some feelings in that. And, you know, I think that's one of the things. You remember the story about Jeremy Astor and how Roddenberry was talking about, you know, nobody would really feel pain. People would just die. And it's like they were Jedi or something, you know. Oh, they're one with the Force. I have no reason to worry about them. I'm in the 24th century human. It's fine. But here we realize that that's not the way it is. And, you know, again, Deep Space Nine is subtly showing us that these things that happen to these Starfleet officers have a huge impact. You know, we'll find that later on in the series about, like, Miles O'Brien and his dealings with Cardassians and how that affected him. So this just starts a trend that will continue on this show. And I think, you know, as we've talked about many times, it is the thing that makes us gravitate towards this series because, as you said, it feels like the real Starfleet officers of the 24th century, like instead of the Real Housewives of New York, it's, you know, like this is the real life of people. It almost feels like more of a documentary style of what life is like in this century than we've ever gotten before. And that's, even if you don't love Deep Space Nine, I think if you're a Star Trek fan, it's fascinating.
Yeah, because not all Starfleet officers get to serve on the flagship. I can picture some ships, let's say scientific vessels, where they're never in any real danger. That could almost be like an office job.
Oh, God. Can you imagine how boring it would be to be on, like, the Grissom and you're already on a world that everybody's, you know, discovered and made sure there's no real danger. So you're just coming in to, like, take scans of flora and fauna and animal life and...
And if you're part of the key scientific staff on that ship who's actually running all the experiments and going down and gathering things, that could be exciting. But there are a lot of crew that have to just keep that ship running. So, you know, for those guys, it would just be probably like everyday mundane work.
They have more gin and whiskey distilleries on those ships than any other place in the fleet. Like anytime somebody's passing by, like, you know, say the Grissom, well, before it was, destroyed, they'd be like hailing them. Hey, can we pick up a couple bottles of your 2262?
Right. You know, the ship that has the most gin distilleries on it, though, is, of course, the USS Argyle.
Yes, yes, that is true. that ship, I think, just runs on pure gin, so.
Probably. New propulsion system.
One more thing, Chris, before we get away from the tone thing. What I did notice, too, in tone, especially with the Kira character, was the fact that they were going to be giving us some stronger women than we'd seen in Star Trek before. I mean, they tried with TNG, but here they're really going to make good on that. And immediately Kira, to me, stood out as a way of saying, this isn't the same type of Star Trek that you're used to. Even in this sense, we're going to be giving you stronger, different types of characters, and especially with, you know, the person we're going to have be the commander and the way that our women interact and how strong they are.
Yeah. Well, picking up on that, I think that's still a case of them easing us into it a bit because she's not a Starfleet officer and because she's a Bajoran. Maybe Sisko's kind of like us in this case, where we're not accustomed to seeing that on Star Trek, and Sisko is not accustomed to seeing that amongst his crew or his colleagues in Starfleet, because he comes in and he's very, I think as you mentioned before we started recording on the other side of the orb, that Sisko is very diplomatic at the beginning of this episode, and he comes in acting like the Starfleet officer that we would expect. And, you know, he thinks, I'm here, I'm Starfleet, I'm going to help this planet. And obviously they want us to help because we're the Federation and we're going to help them make things better. And immediately he runs into that wall that is Kira, and he's kind of taken aback by it. And then he's going to tell her, well, look, you know, you and I have to find a way to work together. But before he can even say that, she's already ignoring him again. And she's talking to Odo about a security situation on the promenade. And what that also shows is not only are we seeing an environment that's different from what we're accustomed to and what Starfleet captains, commanders, and officers are accustomed to, but they're not even at the top of the totem pole in this situation, right? We hear later on, Quark tells Odo that if I'm a thief, you haven't been able to prove it for 4 years. So there's this history already for the station, which we'll learn about later in the series. So Sisko's coming into the situation where the people that are already there don't care that he's the commander of the station yet. And that's something else in tone that we're absolutely not accustomed to.
No, it's... I think one of the things that was really interesting about the way that Sisko deals with all of that is how he just completely rolls with the punches. You know? Like... there's nothing that gets to him. The only thing that gets to him in the episode is having to go talk to Picard. Other than that, you know, he navigates these different cultures here on his station, you know, the one that he's going to be responsible for, with such ease and grace that it's pretty astounding. And in a way that, you know, and I'm thinking of other captains and commanders in Star Trek, I mean, he navigates Ferengi culture and knowing how to deal with them. He is very deferential, as long as he can be, to Kira and to Odo and to everybody else. He's feeling it out. He's doing what a good, you know, commander and manager of this station is going to have to do. What is everybody's strength? And then encourage them in that. You know, like, it's really interesting to watch how different he is than other, you know, Starfleet officers that we've seen, especially ones that are going to be the quote-unquote captain of the show, even though he's the commander at this point.
Well, I think he's more hands-on. You know, Picard would have had Riker handle all this stuff. But at the same time, Riker's a commander, Sisko's a commander, So perhaps it makes more sense that Sisko, having not been elevated to the rank of captain yet, is more accustomed to having to do things hands-on like this than a captain would be, especially a captain of a really, really large ship like Picard.
No, I agree with you. And I love the way that they just deal with his character here. And I think the diplomacy with which he deals with even just say Quark and the Ferengi, and the way that he requests, you know, a Bajoran officer to serve with him on purpose, you know, he understands. You make this their own.
I'm glad he did it on purpose. I could see him like accidentally requesting a Bajoran officer. Oh man, I checked the wrong box on the form. Damn. All right. Well, while we're talking about Sisko, and we mentioned Picard here as well, let's talk about that discussion that they have, or I was going to say confrontation, because the one place where Sisko is not acting diplomatic and is not being careful about what he says is when he talks to Picard. You know, his animosity towards Picard, which is understandable because he blames Picard for the death of Jennifer, his wife, is very, very on the surface, very much on the surface. And Picard is very taken aback by it initially, although I think that in the way that Patrick Stewart plays the scene, you can also see that Picard can understand why some Starfleet officers may feel that way, even if he thinks it's a bit ridiculous. And again, I think too that in the world of Star Trek ideals, you would be able, as Sisko, to say, you know what, that wasn't Picard, that was Locutus. Picard didn't know what he was doing, so I shouldn't blame him. In the reality of life and how we think as humans, and it's something that probably isn't going to change just because a few centuries pass, we can't really set that aside, right? Because we're looking at the same person. And so we see that with Sisko. But the other thing that I think is important about that scene is that it's, again, part of setting the tone for the series, that we're going to have a very different captain here. We're not going to do things the same way. We're not going to bite our tongue and pretend like everything's just fine. We're going to let the lead of our show say, I don't want to be here. Maybe you should find somebody else. I'll do the best job I can right now, but I still don't like you and I still don't like this assignment. And from my perspective, this is a temporary thing. And that's, again, I think quite a stark contrast to the message of TNG.
It was really interesting watching the way that Patrick Stewart reacts to that, because when Sisko tells him, you know, I was at Wolf 359 and we met in battle, his face and his whole demeanor just deflates.
Well, it's kind of like, oh, this again? It's like he's encountered this from many other Starfleet officers in the past.
Huh, that's interesting you take it like that, because I didn't. I took it more as, it felt like to me he was getting self-protective. He got very businesslike, and he was trying to get the meeting over with as soon as possible, which to me very much feels like the way that Picard feels about his experience with the Borg, because it has such an impact on him.
But do you think that's also because he's had to deal with this already a number of times, and he's just saying, well, I'm not going to deal with this again. Let's just get this over with.
It could be, but I felt like it was more of the reminder brought him to a place he didn't want to be in anymore, or he didn't want to think about. And so that just for me, that was kind of where I landed.
Maybe if Picard had gone down to see Kaio Paka and he had an orb encounter, that's where he would have gone.
You know, that actually, it could have been. And it's interesting when you, God, Chris, I think you actually just really landed on something though. I think that Picard and Sisko are actually in the same place. They're both living in the past, and we'll see that in First Contact.
Oh, yeah.
So, wow, great insight, Chris.
Yeah, but that's very true. Yeah, they are in the same place. They are living in the past. And especially, maybe Picard has moved on or made more of an effort to move on, but something like this will trigger it and take him back to it again.
Yeah. I think you brought up something interesting, is how many times this has happened to him. Because do you remember how many ships were lost at Wolf 359? And when you think about how many people are on those ships, that's a lot of people, you know, that he, again, inadvertently is responsible for their death. It's not his fault, because the Borg took him and he had no control over it. But at the same time, I think it's hard for him not even to feel responsible for it, you know? So, but we can all blame it on Q. It's his fault. He introduced us to the Borg, so it's really just his fault.
Well, just a quick check to put some numbers behind what you're saying, because it's important for showing how much it would weigh on him. There were 39 ships destroyed. 11,000 people were killed. So that is a lot to weigh on you.
Yeah, that is a lot of people. When you think about the responsibility of your actions, that's...
Yeah. But whether or not he's really responsible is for another discussion.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a big thing. But pitting Sisko and Picard against each other was a really interesting move, because going into it, you're going to expect it to be a happy handoff, right? But it's not. Not a happy handoff. And that was quite interesting. The way we have our discussion outline set up, we're probably not going to, you know, we're not going through the episode scene by scene. So I just want to mention right now, because we're talking about Picard and the Enterprise, I love the moment when Miles beams back over to the station and the Enterprise leaves, because of, well, not only do I like the scene and the dialogue, but the musical cues are really nice, because they take some cues straight out of TNG, and then the Enterprise leaves and they're gone. And from that point forward, the story is all DS9, except for when they mention, like, maybe the Enterprise is going to be able to come back and help us if we can give them a few days. But it's really a DS9 story after that. So we have Sisko and Picard talk. We have Miles go back and visit the Enterprise. He beams back to the station. Music from TNG. Enterprise is gone. And now the new series is really there. They eased us in. And that happens at about, I think it's about 38 minutes into the episode. So that first 38 minutes is easing us into this new show. And then it's like you're pushing, when you have a kid and you're teaching them how to ride a bike, and you're pushing them from behind, and then you know they've got it, and then you let go, and then they're pedaling away. That's us 39 minutes into this episode.
Training wheels are off, Mom, look!
That's right.
Oh, goodness.
All right. Well, let's talk about, obviously, religion being introduced into Star Trek. That happens right off the bat here in this episode. It's kind of divisive, you know. I mean, I've seen people even in the Babel Conference this week posting about how they hate it when they hear people talk about it being a good thing that religion was introduced into DS9. I don't really know how you do the series and tell the story that they told without having religion as part of the story. Now, you could just completely rewrite it from the beginning without that component, but of course it would be a totally different and I think a less interesting story. And the thing for me is, I don't think that you have to be religious. You don't have to be a believer yourself in any particular religion in order to appreciate what the religious component does for the series.
I couldn't agree with you more, Chris. And I think that what makes this introduction so interesting is that we have seen in Star Trek till this point, TNG and TOS have always portrayed religion as being something that is basically a straw man so that we can push it over and show it to be silly and something people shouldn't believe in. You know, I think of Who Watches the Watchers, or, you know, any of the variety of TOS episodes where that happens, where, you know, Kirk talks to Geth, the supercomputer, many times on a planet.
Well, it's always presented as a superstition, essentially.
Yes, yes. And What's great here is that they actually flesh out and show something real that has validity, so that you really can come to a conversation about interpretations and points of view and all of those wonderful things that actually help intelligent conversation. You know, and even if you're somebody, Chris, you're not a believer, I am one. But right. We can have great conversations back and forth because neither of us finds the other's view ridiculous or dumb, or that we're not, you know, smart for thinking that, because we can put ourselves in each other's shoes. I think Star Trek Deep Space Nine helps people to maybe be able to do that in a way they hadn't been able to do that with Star Trek before. And I think that's pretty wonderful. And you know, as they just recently talked about this on Metatrex, and I really encourage anyone to listen to that episode, because I think Mike and Zach did a great job about talking about this. Religion has been around on this planet since man existed. So I don't think that just because we progressed a couple of hundred years into the future that it's going to go away. So no. Finding a way to deal with somebody who believes and one who doesn't, that's always going to be something that we have to deal with. And I think it was wise of them to be able to talk about this in this kind of manner and do it respectfully of people that are of belief. Because, again, we also talk about, in our day and age, the idea of representation, and people want to be represented. Well, in Star Trek, religion has always been represented as something for the simple-minded or the moron, basically, to believe that. Just let me show you the man behind the curtain. That's pretty much what it's always been said. Whereas, again, Deep Space Nine treats this with such wonderful nuance as to say, maybe or maybe not. It's up for you to make that choice. And isn't that Star Trek? I mean, isn't that infinite diversity and infinite combinations?
Yeah.
So I think it's wonderful.
In Emissary, the other interesting angle to having religion introduced is the fact that it's tied into the Starfleet commander of the station. And we see it very early on when Sisko's walking through the station and one of the Bajoran monks comes out of the temple and greets him and invites him in. And Sisko says, not now, but he tells him the prophets await you. And Sisko's not ready to go in, and he says, maybe another time. And they say, another time. And then later he goes down and he meets Kaiopaka, and he experiences the Bajoran spirituality firsthand. And you can tell that it's, again, I think it's uncomfortable for him. And of course, at this point, he has no idea that he is actually tied into this religion in any way. But I think it's uncomfortable for him. But I think, again, as we talked about earlier, he handles it in a very diplomatic way. Now, obviously, the orb experience, the orb encounter that he has, is something tangible. And I guess we talked about this on the Ready Room recently when we did In the Hands of the Prophets, the fact that when you deal with the Bajoran religion, there are tangible connections that you have to the gods of that religion that we don't have here on Earth. And having that encounter for Sisko, again, maybe it eases him into the idea and maybe makes it easier for him to work together with someone like Kaiopaka and with the Bajoran culture in general.
Well, and I think one of the wonderful things that they do here, and I feel like you can tell that the people behind this show have some understanding of religious belief, in that most people that are of faith have had some kind of experiences which have led them to that. Experiences they believe, you know, with their God or connection in some way to that. So it's built on both of rational thought and their experience. And what's wonderful here in Deep Space Nine is they're going to build that into the show as well. Experiential relationship with whoever it is that you believe in. And they do a wonderful job of showing that between somebody like Sisko, who's the non-believer, Kira, and then what we'll see later with, you know, Kai Wynn, or she'll become Kai Wynn later on. So those three characters give us three different versions of being involved in religious belief and faith from three different perspectives.
Well, Kai Opaka as well. I mean, sticking with emissary, Kai Opaka as well. And we see her devotion to it and what it means to her early in the first season when we get the battle lines. But I think that it's also fortunate with the storyline of Emissary that it is Kai Opaka who greets Sisko and not someone like Vedic Wynn. That would have changed the entire tone of the story.
And I completely agree. And I think, again, that's the power that they show here for the way that religion and faith can be a wonderful thing. As Kira said, our religion is the only thing that kept us together. In the same way, when you think about, and obviously they are referencing very heavily the Holocaust and the Jews that survived that, so many of them would say that is the only thing that has that kept us alive. I mean, just in general, the Jews throughout history, their faith, their belief is what kept them together, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think we've seen it in our own world. And, you know, religion can be good and bad. So can non-belief. I mean, non-belief can be good and bad as well. I mean, so there's atrocities on both sides of that coin. So, you know, don't start quoting me numbers because I can quote numbers back at you. That's not what it's about. It's about trying to understand one another, and that's the wonderful thing of what Sisko is trying to do here.
Yeah, exactly. The orb encounter itself, so when he goes down to see Kai Opaka, is... I'm trying to think back to when I saw it the first time, but certainly when I rewatch it now and when I watch the other pilots, it's just so unique in Star Trek to... Well, it's unique and it's not. I mean, I can see... In TNG, I'm going to just stick with TNG because it was the series right before this one and they're really contemporaries. I can see something similar to this happening on that show. It would just have a different meaning and it would not have a lasting consequence like it does here. It wouldn't set a character down a path that they're going to be following for a long time. It would just be sort of a one-off experience that they had in this one episode. And of course, it would be resolved at the end and we would find out that the orb was actually some kind of alien device and we would find out how it worked and there would be some medical solution to it or something like that. And of course here, that's not what we get. But what's also very important, again, is the way that they weigh the character of Sisko down with his past, but they set it up in a positive way before they weigh him down with the trauma of what happened, because we'll get the trauma in the second part of Emissary, when he's actually in the wormhole. And here, he remembers... I mean, of course it hurts him, no doubt, to see Jennifer and relive those memories because he knows he's lost her. But the memories themselves are the pleasant moments that he had with her.
Yeah. I think anybody that has had a significant other can think back at the time that you first met them and, you know... They're usually very fond memories, and a lot of people would, you know, love to go back and in some ways to relive that somehow. And Sisko gets that opportunity here and gets the same result that apparently he had the first time. You know, she says yes.
Well, I hope so.
You know, I mean,
based on his memories.
Right. No, but what I mean is that, you know, this is... it's a strange dreamlike sequence,
the
way he approaches
it
is completely different than the first time when he landed on her, you know, towel and, you know, woke her up because he probably kicked her with sand and all. I doubt he went with this move of like talking about her as if they've always known each other, you know, but
he's remembering it in as we all do with our memories, right? We probably remember it in a way that omits any of the uncomfortable or the bad moments. That's how our memories were. You know, our memories, our brains are a storage medium. Mm-hmm. that can only hold so much, and it's also chemical based. And so over time, things change, and our memories change over time. And what we might remember 20 years later is similar, but not an accurate representation of what actually happened.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we find out later that the prophets are giving you visions through the orbs. But again, we don't know how much control they have over the visions that they share with you.
Well, and it's interesting, too, you know, and you just to tie that in with, because the other person that we see have an orb encounter. Encounters with the orb. It sounds like a radio show.
Yeah, that or Delilah. A show that would come on really late at night.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of like one of those really spooky mystery shows.
That or it's on Bajor. Hello and welcome to Encounters with the Orb. I'm Matthew Rushing, and tonight we'll be playing the soft jazz hits.
I bet there is. I bet there is a Bajoran podcast like that. Yeah. Go to Bajoran iTunes. I bet it's in New and Noteworthy.
Oh, man.
Or but, what's hot. It's probably been around for thousands of years.
It's so cool because, you know, Sisko has a orb encounter, and it's a good one, and the same thing happens to Jensia. It's a beautiful memory for her of the time that she was joined, which also, at the same point, gives all of us fans a look at what joining looks like for Trill, since we've only seen a Trill once on, you know, Next Generation.
The Perfect Mate, and was a very different Trill.
Exactly. So it's interesting that both orb experiences for both of the Starfleet characters are ones that bring and recall good memories. And it won't be until they get to, you know, the Celestial Temple that the prophets will change things, at least for Sisko.
You know, I think that, and I guess we shouldn't jump ahead to that because that's going to be in our second part, but I just think that that's because at this point, the orb is just giving you a vision. It's pulling things up from your memory. Whereas what we see in the second part is them trying to understand something, and then they're really controlling what you see as a way for them to understand. But we'll talk about that when we get to part two so that we don't jump ahead too far. So, okay, well, let's talk about a few other things here. Characters coming over, bridging the gap, making it easy for TNG fans to come over to the new series. We have Miles O'Brien. Now, of course, everyone knows that originally they wanted to have Ro Laren as the first officer, and that didn't work out, and so we got Kira. But we do have Miles here, and he was a secondary character for sure. I mean, his importance over the course of TNG kept growing and growing, and he had been there since Encounter at Farpoint, where we see him there on the battle bridge, even sitting in the controls. But he's a very likable character, and I think a likable actor. Is he the perfect person to bring over for you, or would you have done something different?
You know, I don't think there's anybody else. You know, TNG was not very good with its recurring characters, and therefore, you know, I don't think you're going to bring Guinan over or something and make her the bartender at Quark's.
No, they should have brought Guinan over, and she could open a competing bar right across the promenade from Quark's.
Oh, yeah, that would be awesome. It could be like 10 Forwarder or something. Yeah.
Well, and think about how the relationship could have been between Guinan and Garrick. You know, he would be making hats for her all the time.
Oh, gosh. I'm just imagining the elaborate hats that Garrick would make Guinan. That would be fantastic. You know, the other recurring characters that we're going to get, I mean, we're going to get Luxana later on, but I mean, she's not going to be somebody you'd make a main character.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about people who are really always there. So you have Miles, and then you have Keiko, who's very much a secondary character even here.
Yeah, but I can't think, you know, you're not going to take Worf or Data or anybody like that from TNG and put them on, you know, Deep Space
right.
Nine.
Not when the show is still running for
a couple more seasons. It's great, though, that, Miles just becomes such a fantastic character in his own right. Obviously, in hindsight, they made the perfect choice because right. I can't imagine Deep Space Nine without Miles O'Brien. I mean, when he kicks the console, like, what's wrong with this damn thing? I mean, it was just perfect, and I can't imagine anybody else from the Enterprise doing that. You know, Geordi's not going to do that.
No.
But O'Brien, it just, for some reason, it felt perfect, that kind of Irish temper getting the better of him. He's in this place that's dirty and nothing's working right, and he's used to being on the flagship where everything works right. I mean, he's just recalibrating for extra, you know, power, not just trying to get one transport in the first place. So, it's...
Well, I think also he was a character that was really ready to shine, and certainly an actor who was more than capable of taking on a lead role. Not to say that the other secondary characters or background characters on TNG weren't, that those actors weren't, but I think with Colm Meaney, you had an actor on TNG who was severely underutilized on that show. And all you needed to do was put him in the front, give him some good material, and let him go with it. And he just is phenomenal. He's one of my favorite actors on Star Trek. And if I think back to the time that it came on, I think Miles was a character that TNG fans knew well enough that they did care about the character, but removing him from TNG did not affect the show in any way. So it was easy to move him over, and people would still care about finding out where his story was going to go. So it was enough to pique the interest of TNG fans and create that connection between the two series.
Definitely. I think he is, again, you know, when you talk about the very small amount of secondary characters on The Next Generation, you know, I think they made a great choice, the best choice they could have made.
So other characters, as is always the case with a pilot, a lot of the time is spent with us meeting characters who are going to be on the show. And you already talked about Kira up front. And the first thing we see of her is arguing, slamming her fist on a control panel and yelling, "You're throwing it all away."
Yeah, and that's not going to be her only good line in this pilot. So I will save that for the next show. But, you know, immediately she grabs you. You know, she is, and I love O'Brien's line, "Have you ever served with any Bajoran women, sir?" You know,
no,
the fact
why?
That, you know, they are known for being very strong and vocal and opinionated and strong-willed. It's really fantastic. So it's one of my favorite parts of watching Deep Space Nine, because Kira's character and her arc is going to be only second to Sisko, I think. And that's an amazing thing because, you know, unfortunately on TNG, the female characters were so underserved. It's utterly ridiculous. I mean, that's why Denise Crosby left the show. She didn't have anything to do but had to be on set for 18 hours a day so they could stare at her legs, behind the horseshoe. It's frustrating for them. I can see that. Here, she got something to do.
I would love to see TNG rewritten. I'm not saying I want to see a reboot or anything. I'm just saying, like, if you could take it and it was produced for the first time, even with the same cast, today, I'd love to see that. I'd love to see how they would write those characters.
Well, goodness, it would look a lot more like Enterprise, I think. With obviously just even the sexiness of the show would be ramped up and stuff. Riker is already perfectly there for that.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about the sexiness. I'm talking about how I think that the female characters would be put on equal footing with the male characters in terms of their roles on the ship and having stuff to do and having meaningful dialogue.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think, you know, you definitely wouldn't have had Yar or, you know, Deanna Troi just kind of in the background as some kind of window dressing. It just wouldn't have been like that.
Well, Deanna would not have been a counselor if the show were made today. That was very much a late 80s decision.
Yeah. This is true.
What do you think about the other characters? The Ferengi are interesting. You know, when we had Aaron Eisenberg here on the show, he mentioned that he went back to kind of find out who the Ferengi were. But then they moved forward from there. And you see a little bit of that here, like with the hiss. But what Armin does with Quark, it's already a new take on Ferengi, a very new take on Ferengi.
It's wonderful, Chris. I mean, there's no energy whips. There's no fur. Right. So already we're head and shoulders above anything they did on TNG with the Ferengi. And immediately this guy is kind of likable. And you know what? The one thing, and this is great that I can reference this because it's my favorite movie. This feels so much like Casablanca. No. That small city where everybody comes to, but nobody necessarily wants to be at. You know, you have the bar, and obviously, Quark's kind of supposed to be Rick. He's just not as smooth. And that's what I kind of love, is he feels, in some ways, it's like Rick and Ugati, the guy at the very beginning there in Casablanca who has the letters of transit, the kind of slimy guy. It's like those two characters put together. And so I just really, really enjoy that. And what is interesting about it is when I found myself watching this again before we started recording, Chris, is Quark is really fascinating character already. You know, he's already different enough to make me want to continue to see where this character is going to go. And then the bar is just a fantastic scene. I mean, who doesn't love a musical rock statue that you play with, you know, like rock cucumbers? Right. I mean, that's fantastic.
I'm surprised Think Geek has not made that yet.
The rock musical instrument that you have to buy cucumbers to play with it? That's weird. But yeah, everybody would want one.
Yeah, they could do a tie-up with Trader Joe's. You know, you get the cucumbers there. You order the rock from Think Geek.
The cucumbers have to come from Trader Joe's.
Right.
Musical cucumbers.
Special Bajoran organic cucumbers. So, yeah, but you know, there's a history for Quark, which is... It's nice in this story right off the bat, just in him talking to Sisko, trying to get Nog from being put into the brig, and exchanges with Odo as well, the one I mentioned earlier about, if I am a thief, you haven't been able to prove it for 4 years, shows that there's this history that you want to learn more about. And also the fact that instead of creating a new alien race, they actually took a race that we already knew. And not only that, but they took a race that most fans felt was a failure in terms of storytelling up to this point. The Ferengi obviously didn't turn out the way they had intended. And they say, okay, we're going to use this race and we're going to make a new character, but we're going to just go in another direction with it. And we're going to take some aspects of the culture that you know, the greed, the love for money and commerce, but we're going to really go somewhere else with that. And I think they set it up quite well here in these few scenes in the first part of Emissary with Quark. About Odo, how did you feel about Odo in terms of just seeing him here in the first half of Emissary? Of course, he's a shapeshifter. They do spend a lot of money on CGI for him in this episode, which they pretty quickly get away from as the series goes on. Because I guess once you know he can do it, you don't really need to see him do it all the time, right? But did you find Odo to be a very interesting character right off the bat when you didn't know anything about where his story was going to go? Or did he just seem kind of like a gimmick for CGI and, oh, here's something that's really alien you haven't seen before because we have the ability with computers now to do this?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. I do find him interesting, but he's not the most interesting character that we get here. And because of that, he is less impactful. Now, I remember when I first saw this, it's a different story. Like you said, you'd never seen anything like this on TV before. And we were finally starting to branch out that, yes, he looks humanoid, but he's really not. He's this gelatinous material that creates himself to look like us, you know? Yeah. You know, it wouldn't be till Voyager, again, where we would get aliens that looked nothing like us, like Species 8472. So, and that was only a couple times in the series.
Yeah, that's true. So we talked about Jadzia a little bit earlier when she had her orb experience. The idea of having, again, another character on the show that's very, very different from us, someone who's joined, someone who has centuries of experience and has a connection to our commander, set up a lot for storytelling.
Immediately, I'm enjoying her character, and I think it's the rapport that she has with Avery Brooks. They have a great, interesting relationship already, and it does make you want to know more. He calls her old man for the first time, and she just kind of smiles at him, and it's going to be a thing for them after that. But, you know, it's subtle. The whole thing is subtle. Nothing's like in your face or anything like that. It just, there's a naturalism between them of a camaraderie and friendship that, for me, as I was watching it again, I was like, wow, they really are selling this relationship to me from the very beginning.
Here's something that I want to ask you. On DS9, by having Kira and having Jadzia, it's the first time on Star Trek that we got two female characters in such prominent roles. We had two female characters on TNG, but one was the doctor and one was the counselor. And even by the way they dressed Troi on TNG, you know, she was kind of different from the rest of the crew. She's the counselor, but she's not really that senior. She's often on the bridge because she's there to counsel Picard, but she's not that senior bridge staff. She's not that crew. Whereas here you've got your first officer and your senior science officer, both being female. But the catch is that with Jadzia, yes, she's female, but she was male the last time Sisko saw her. And throughout her life, she's been male and female, kind of back and forth. Do you see that as a way of them trying to introduce another strong female character, but not go all the way to kind of say, well, yes, but this is kind of a different situation?
You know, I'd say, Chris, that what was really interesting about the way that they deal with both of these characters, one is Kira is the first officer, so something we've always seen played by a man. And then Dax is the science officer, the thing that we've traditionally always seen done by a man, you know, Spock the most famous. And to me, it's a clear delineation of saying, hey, we are separating ourselves. We are making sure that women are more at the forefront, and they're not just going to be counselors and caregivers, you know, they're going to be scientists and leaders and all of those things. So I really do think that, and I love what we get here. I think they're just so well done and so well played. I never question, I mean, you know, I'm watching it the first time when I was, you know, I guess was in my teens yet, really, but you know, I didn't question it then, and it just seemed natural to me. It was, and they were good characters, and that's really all that mattered. What do you do with your characters? They just need to be good characters.
Well, exactly. That's how I feel in general. And it was just a thought that popped into my head. I think in what you were saying about science being, the science officer being a character that was typically male, you know, there's always been this idea in society in general that science is something that men do, right? And so encouraging girls to study science has always been important and sometimes challenging. And let's remember again that this was made in 1993, or actually shot in 1992. And so we're talking 23 years ago now, going on 24 years. Mm-hmm. And so back then, it was still, we had not made as much progress as we have now in terms of having more women in sciences. And so having Jadzia as the science officer is a great way to show that progression.
Yeah, no, I think it's fantastic. And again, it just feels so organic, and it's not in your face. It just is.
Yeah, it just
is. And that's fantastic.
Which is important. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and then we have Bashir. We haven't talked about him. And I don't know, what's your take on Bashir at the beginning here? Just this introduction. We don't see him much in the first half of Emissary. Really, we see him getting off of the transport with Jadzia.
You know, what I find interesting about Bashir is that he is He's very different than anything we've experienced before. We've never, I don't feel like, up to this point, really had, I guess since TOS with Chekhov, the really young officer. And you know, the fact that Bashir is right out of basically the academy, he is a brilliant doctor. And as he said, he could have had anything he wanted, as in Fleet's choice of positions. And he chooses, you know, this frontier medicine place. And he has, is subtly, and not so subtly at the same time, he has this arrogance of the Federation about him.
Yeah.
And I think people see that as Bashir's arrogance, but I also feel like that he's also portraying some of the arrogance that we see in the Federation of, we're better than you, we're going to come save you.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, especially in his exchanges with Kira.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not just that the character is like that. He's also just portraying a whole part of Star Trek that we have seen through TOS and TNG.
Well, and the ladies' man part, you know, it's a little bit of Riker in there, a little bit of Kirk, or at least the perception
he's
of Kirk.
He's just not quite as productive as...
Yeah, he's not as successful as Riker.
Successful, sure. Yes. There you go.
He's more like Geordi in that sense, right?
At least in the beginning, you know. I mean, he definitely becomes more of a ladies' man. I mean, he does date Lita later on. And
well, he gets a lot more confidence later.
That's true.
Let me ask you, does he remind you a little bit in what you were describing as being the young Starfleet officer and sort of the excitement that he has, but also kind of being a little bit, you know, a little bit green? Does he remind you a little bit of Sonia Gomez?
Oh, man. He just doesn't happen to, you know, drop anything on anyone, some hot chocolate or anything on somebody. So, yeah.
It would have been funny if it's like an homage to Q Who if he accidentally spilt hot chocolate all over Sisko.
That would have been pretty funny.
But he does remind me a little bit of her, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah, that's great, Chris. I wish I had thought of that myself.
Nothing I've thought of before, but when I was listening to you describe him, that popped into my head. All right. Well, those are all the main characters, right, that we meet in the first half of Emissary. And the last thing to talk about here is just the idea of destiny in this episode, because that's another thing that I guess is kind of new to Star Trek for us. I mean, I think I could go through TOS and TNG and pick out some situations where maybe we could say destiny was at play. But here, especially with the way that they set up Sisko's character, there really is this sense of destiny. Like, he doesn't want to be there, but he's supposed to be there.
What's so interesting about this story to me is the idea of destiny. And again, this is playing upon the idea of the relationship with religion. But as we've talked about, Chris, this also sets up this idea of kind of mythology for Deep Space Nine. And the storytelling that they are going to go for is more mythic. And because of that, the wonderful thing about watching Deep Space Nine is that when you rewatch it, the themes still stand out because they're not specifically tied to just one time period. It feels more timeless. It's because they tie it to these ideas of faith and destiny and all of this stuff that has played so much a part of all of human history. It's bigger than life. You know, we're talking about how this is the life of the 24th century, but at the same time, it's also bigger than life. And it almost is bigger than Star Trek, really.
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you replaced the elements, the Star Trek elements in Deep Space Nine with elements from some other universe, then you could still tell a very similar story, right? Just the basics of the story, you could do that. And in terms of destiny, we could also get into, we're not going to do it today, but we could get into the whole existence of the Bajorans and who the prophets are and the Cardassian occupation.
Yes.
I mean, you could get into all of it in terms of that. One more thing to talk about here. I think I said one more thing a moment ago, but because we're not going scene by scene here, but we mentioned that we would be going up to the point where they leave to go explore the Denorius Belt. We should talk a little bit about the encounter that Sisko has with Dukat, because that's, of course, going to be setting up what happens in the second part here. And Dukat comes over, and again, it's very difficult for us to do this, trying to look at this as if it's the first time that we've seen it and a new series is being set up. What do you think about Dukat himself when he comes in? He was the guy running the show, and also how Sisko handles that situation.
What I love about him is that he's immediately swarmy. Like, you get the creeps from him.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, without putting all the rest of the series on it, just watching this first half of the episode, that's what I come away with. This guy is no good. That's it. You know, this guy's no good.
Yeah, he's no
good.
You
know, and that, the way it's played and everything is just pitch perfect to give you that sense that no matter what will ever happen in this series, this guy's no good. And, you know, I remember too, just rewatching it, when Kira says he was the prefect in charge of the Bajoran occupation, it's like a concentration camp leader coming back to the concentration camp, and it's just it gives you the willies, you know, and that's perfect. That's exactly what they're going for. So it's the best introduction to a villain in Star Trek, I think.
Well, Sisko also handles it both in a strong Sisko way, but also in a diplomatic way. He does not get into a real confrontation, and he doesn't say a whole lot, actually, right? He just tells him, drop by anytime you're feeling homesick. We'll try to keep the dog off your lawn. And then when Dukat tells him that, you know, I know you have an orb, Sisko's just like, I don't know anything about an orb. But the way he says it is, like, I think later on, Sisko could sell that a lot better. But it does come off a bit like, okay, yeah, you caught me, but I'm going to say I don't know anything about it.
I'm going to say I don't know anything about it because you don't have a play here. So it doesn't really matter what you know.
But it perfectly sets up, even though there's not a lot to this, it perfectly sets up all the encounters that these two are going to have over the course of the series. I mean, they planted the seed really, really well here.
I would just say that on a whole, even this first part is very successful in a lot of areas in making me interested in wanting to continue, which is, you know, when you're talking about a pilot, that's fantastic. And then as we talk about full circle, this pilot and the end are going to come full circle, and that's what's going to be wonderful as well.
Definitely. All right. And so after this, of course, Jadzia and Sisko head on out, and we're kind of in the middle of the episode now, and that's where they generally split it. So next time on The Orb, we'll talk about the rest of Emissary, and we'll probably get more into what's actually happening in terms of the scenes, because the first half is so much about introductions. And there are those key moments, which we did talk about, the orb encounters and some of those elements. But, you know, we've got the series set up now. We've got the tone. And as I mentioned earlier, when Miles beams back to the station and the Enterprise leaves and you get that great final little TNG musical cue, now you're really into DS9. So let us know what you think about the first half of Emissary. You can find us in the Babel Conference on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field, and that will bring it right on up. It is a closed group, so you need to click join. We have about 900 people in there right now, and we have great discussions. So hit us up over there. Also on Twitter, TrekFM is our username. Trek.fm/contact is where you'll find our contact form. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come right on over to Matthew and me. And you can even send us voicemail if you go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. And while you're waiting for this next episode of The Orb to come out for the second part of Emissary, check out all the other great shows we have here on the network. Here's a quick look at some of those.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit. sure, it's got the cheesy alien and the cheesy fight scenes, but that's Star Trek. I'm sorry. That's the original series.
Oh, yeah.
And no, I'm not going to apologize for it. That's Star Trek.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
Yeah, deal with it.
Earl Grey.
Well, it does all those cloak experiments. It deployed that communications array.
Minefield?
And the minefield for exploratory purposes.
Let's not talk about the Defiant, because you know it's just going to upset me.
To the journey!
It's very much the genesis of Seven of Nine.
Genesis alone is not! Sorry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
You know what? See, the thing is now, if Star Trek Beyond goes sideways in any way, you've planted that line in my brain. And I'm like, I only got half a peg. And I'm just going to trot that out if I don't like Star Trek Beyond.
The 602 Club.
Or staying and trying to turn this guy and almost become the mentor, and he becomes more of the student because he's insane, and trying to bring sanity back to him because there's such few
Jedi.
Well, and I think that's what Luke was going to do until Mara showed up and needed his help, and she went with him.
Literary Treks.
The pinnacle of episode that we've ever done on that was probably when we had Tristan from To the Journey on to talk about some Voyager comics, and we ended up, that show was named Tuvok's Remedial School for Badasses or something of that nature, so I mean... Yeah, these old comics can just be very, very fun.
Meta Treks.
You're not going to see a bunch of Klingons hanging around eating cake and you know, laughing at
well, Klingon unless cake. Unless it's a peptide cake with mint frosting.
Peptide, indeed.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So get these shows everywhere you get your podcasts. Of course, we're in iTunes, where we're a featured content provider. You can find us at itunes.com/trekfm, or just search Trek FM in iTunes, and it'll come right on up. And we have our master feed, which has every episode of every show we do. That's a great way to sample the network. And then you can also find us, if you're not an iTunes user, on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. Go to our website, stream from the pages there, download the MP3 files, grab the RSS link. We have so many ways for you to take in all of our podcasts, and we try to make it as easy as possible for you to listen to all of those.
Well, Chris, we'd really like to thank our associate producers through Patreon. These people make sure that this show is possible each and every week that we can bring it to you. As you know, Chris and I have some crazy schedules, and sometimes we're not able to get to you as much as we like, but we do our best, and it's because of Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, Ken Tripp, that we can bring this show to you. And we appreciate them and their support as being associate producers here through Patreon. What's great about them is that they understood is Trek FM is a listener-supported network, and that means that we need your help to be able to bring all this great content to you. There are so many costs that go along with running a network of this magnitude. You know how many shows we bring you, and we try to keep our shows as clean as possible. Not a lot of ads or anything like that. It's just pure content, pure Star Trek goodness, and beyond. So if you would like to join the team, you can check us out at patreon.com/trekfm. And you can see all the different perks that we have for you. We have some great things. Chris, you just set up patron.zone, which is an amazing place for all of our patron members at $5 or more to be able to go. They can get shows before anybody else and exclusive content that nobody else can get, which is really fun. We've put some silly things up there, ringtones, all sorts of great stuff. And at $15, Chris, fans can join in at the Patreon roundtables that we do twice a month with Will Wynn as the host. And it's so cool because fans get to be on their own podcast every month talking about different aspects of Star Trek. So,
and we put that out there for everyone to listen to as well.
That's right. It goes right into the master feed, just like all the other shows. So you can star on your own podcast with the rest of the producers, associate producers, and the hosts from around the network twice a month. So be sure to check all of that out at patreon.com/trekfm.
Yeah, everyone, thanks so much for your support. We really, really appreciate it. And it really is thanks to you guys that the network keeps going. So please check us out over there. One more quick plug, Matthew, is about our store, because we're coming up on the holidays. We have this really cool new holiday card that's in the shape of a Christmas tree, but it is made up of elements from Star Trek, and that's available, again, as a card, but you can also get it. I've seen a few people this week buy it as a shirt, and it's available as mugs or whatever you like. Plus, we've got many, many other great designs there in the store, all done by our wonderful art director, Aaron Harvey. And that's another way to support the network, because when you make purchases through the store, we get a small cut of that money, and that helps us pay for all of our costs as well. Plus, you get some really great, really awesome merchandise there. That's over on Redbubble. There are several ways to get there. Go to trek.fm/store. You can see the artwork there, most of it. And if you click through one of the images, it'll take you to the actual store. Or go to trekfm.link/trekfmstore, and that will take you there. Or go to Redbubble and just search for Trek FM. And we have so many great items there. Please go check those out. Great holiday gift ideas as well. They're on the promenade, as we call it, the Trek FM store.
Now, Chris, when you're not wandering through Deep Space Nine trying to find the restroom and all of that mess that the Cardassians left, where can we find you?
Well, I have found the restroom before, Matthew. Apparently, it's actually near my office in Tokyo, because there's a sign on this men's restroom that says that the closing time for the restroom is 2600.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Clearly,
nice.
Clearly Bajoran, right? Well, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's also my username on Facebook and pretty much everywhere. You can find me in the Babel Conference and then elsewhere on the network. You can find me on The Ready Room, where we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series and Star Trek news. And in fact, the next episode that's going to drop around the same time as this orb has Matthew on there, but we're not talking DS9, we're talking Enterprise. So be sure to check out that show. I also do our short news show Hyperchannel from time to time, and Continuing Mission, which is about independent productions and fan films. And then if you'd like to read my writing on Star Trek, you can find that over on the official website at StarTrek.com. Just search for my name. That's probably the easiest way. C. Brian Jones is the name on there. And Matthew, when you're not hanging out with Garrick trying to come up with the best new hat designs for Guinan, where can people find you?
Chris, that takes all of my time. I'm tweeting about it at MattRushing02. I'm on Instagram about it, MRushing, where Trek FM is now, so just check that out. I do, of course, Literary Treks with Dan when I'm not busy with the hat design, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek, and of course, we're interviewing the authors. We don't do a lot of hat design on the 602 Club, but you can check that out. It's a great place. We talk about all things geeky there that don't have anything to do with Star Trek, because we talk a lot of Star Trek on the network. And, of course, there's a lot of great Star Wars stuff there right now. We just talked about Jessica Jones, the new Netflix series, so check all of that out at the 602 Club. And I have my own personal blog, 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com, where Chris, I have my article up that I wrote for your magazine, Metropolis, there in Japan, which was my first published paid article. So I feel so honored. It was so wonderful to get the opportunity to do something like that and to write about something that I love, Star Wars.
Yeah, and I will tell you that that issue disappeared very quickly around the city.
Well, Chris, you were showing me some behind-the-scenes things of that, and I mean, the cover alone is gorgeous. So I'm really looking forward to my copies being sent to me, and so I can frame them and put them on the wall. So you can check that out at my own personal blog. So, well, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.